This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 93 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing whether alternate universes in the Star Trek universe really exist, what is sometimes known in physics as multiverse theory, or in philosophy as modal realism. Mike, how are you today?
I really feel like I have been in a parallel quantum parallel universe where Mike and Zach do not do Metatrex, and I don't podcast except as a guest on other podcasts. That's how I feel right now. But it's great. It's been a while, but here we are. We're on mic, and we're getting ready to do episode 93 of Metatrex.
Well, since we're going to be talking about possible universes, I would go so far as to say we live in the best of all possible universes in which you are going to be a published author very soon.
Very soon. I'm really excited about that. In fact, as we're recording the podcast, I got notification that we are getting ready to go to print for our first editions. So that's very exciting stuff. And of course, we've got a big party planned for September, and release day is October 1. We are on schedule.
That's so exciting, Mike. I could not be happier for you and prouder of you.
Oh,
for seeing
you.
It through. It's hard to write a book, much less get it published.
Well, and I'll say this, Zachary, and I won't spoil some of the dedication notes that I put into the book, but there's a lot of you, my friend, in Hannah Goodhart and A Guardian of Time. You have really given me food for thought over these past 92, getting ready to be 93 episodes, in the way that I see the world, the way I ask questions and make distinctions. And I think there's a lot of you in those pages. So thank you.
Well, if she's half as funny and witty and insightful as we've been in the last 92 episodes of Metatrex, then it's definitely going to be a must read.
Yeah, I think it's going to be. And I will say to all the Star Trek fans out there, obviously you can't write about Star Trek in a non-Star Trek book, but I think Star Trek definitely pops up from time to time in the book. And there are definitely some themes that you'll find consistent in Hannah Goodhart that you'll enjoy watching when you're watching Star Trek. So I just encourage you, when it comes out, to go. It should be on pre-sale about midsummer. Grab a copy of the book and let me know what you think.
Well, Mike, getting back to Star Trek, we see alternate universes in Star Trek several times. We have an alternate timeline in the J.J. Abramsverse movies. Mm-hmm. We have quantum realities in the TNG episode Parallels. We have the mirror universe in several iterations of Star Trek. So alternate universes pop up from time to time in the Star Trek universe. And it seems clear that in the Star Trek universe, alternate universes exist in one form or another. It's been on screen many times. So that's just part of the Star Trek reality. But I think the question for us, the big question, is, do alternate universes really exist? Are they purely science fiction, or are they real in some way? And that view that alternate universes exist is what's known as modal realism in philosophy. So I'm looking forward to talking about this because the concept of alternate universes has a rich history in the history of philosophy, going all the way back to the philosopher Gottfried Leibniz, who said that we live in the best of all possible worlds. And we'll talk about his argument here in a minute. But I'm anxious to talk about the different ways it comes up in the Star Trek universe, what distinctions we can make and how alternate universes are conceived of inside Star Trek, and some various arguments in the history of philosophy relating to possible universes and alternate universes, and specifically whether the question is a scientific question in the domain of science or is it more of a philosophical question?
And it's a great question. Do alternate universes exist? I tend to defer to something more akin to Occam's razor. I just try to limit the number of things that I say exist and come up with the simplest solution. That's me personally. However, in the Star Trek universe, alternate universes definitely exist. We have, as you mentioned, the quantum realities that we see represented in parallels. And I think that a lot of our discussion here on the podcast today is going to really kind of surround that episode, Parallels, because that's our best example of these quantum realities that that you think about when you're talking about modal realism. However, we've got lots of examples throughout Star Trek of parallel universes, trans-dimensional realms. We have subspace realms. We have other planes of existence, and so we have the anti or the minus universe rather, where we have anti-Lazarus in the alternate factor, the type of thing that we see in the counterclock incident in the original series. We've got a trans-dimensional realm. We've got the realm that the sphere builders live in Enterprise. We have the realm of the prophets where they exist outside of time and space. So there are tons of examples of alternate universes, alternate realities, these trans-dimensional realms within Star Trek. So Star Trek, I think, is saying, yes, alternate universes exist.
See, I knew you would come to my rescue with all of these Star Trek examples that I couldn't think of off the top of my head when I was preparing the notes for today's show.
Yeah, there are plenty of them. There's no shortage of material within the Star Trek universe for this subject. Again, I think when we're talking about modal realism, and that's somewhat, I think, specific in philosophy when we're talking about alternate universes, I think the best example of that, again, is going to be Parallels. Because when we talk about modal realism, we posit, for instance, you know, if I would have chosen to go to Columbia University instead of Welch College, how would my life have been different? And so, you know, and we do this all the time. Well, if I would have chosen B instead of A, or if I would have turned left instead of going right, if I would have gone to RISA instead of to the neutral zone, how would things be different? Well, things would be different, and so on. And we see that a lot in Parallels. In fact, in Worf's life, we see a ton of different things that that could have happened to him, or did happen to him rather, in these parallel quantum universes. So I think when we're talking about modal realism, that's going to be our best example. But there's plenty to talk about when we talk about things like the mirror universe and these trans-dimensional universes and these subspace realms and space-time continuum and so on and so forth. There's tons of stuff that we can dive into.
Well, you hit on something really important a moment ago right off the bat. You said you tend to appeal to Occam's razor. And when you're positing something as metaphysically heavy as an alternate universe, something outside the domain of our universe that we can see and feel and touch, that we have empirical evidence for, anything outside of that is kind of by definition metaphysical, beyond the physical universe. Even if it's another physical universe out there, it's beyond our universe. In order to believe in such a thing, it has to have some sort of explanatory adequacy. It has to explain something here in the universe that can't be explained otherwise. So most of these arguments for alternate universes try to argue that in order for us to make sense of something we do understand, whether it's some phenomenon here in the physical universe, whether it's the truth of some bit of language, like the counterfactual propositions that you were just mentioning, if I had done something, then I would have done something else. Mm-hmm. In order to explain those kinds of things, you have to posit you know, an alternate universe. And that sounds really crazy right off the bat. And we'll talk about how those arguments work in just a moment. But the problem of trying to believe in an alternate universe is analogous to the problem you get in, say, string theory in quantum mechanics. Some versions of string theory posit as many as, say, 23 dimensions. They're mathematical constructs to make the math and the equations come out right. So the interesting question there is, are these alternate dimensions that are posited to make the math come out right purely mathematical constructs for convenience purposes to make the math work? Or are they real? Are there really 23 dimensions out there? I think you can run the same kind of reasoning with alternate universes. They might be useful for explaining the truth of counterfactual statements, but does that mean that they're real, that they really exist in some sort of metaphysical sense beyond the physical universe? And it sounds like philosophical sleight of hand, like what difference does it make if we don't have any access to them? But that's all of metaphysics, right? By definition, metaphysics are things that are beyond the domain of what we, you know, literally beyond physics, beyond the domain of what we have access to here in the universe as we know it. But it's a metaphysically heavy supposition, right? Not only do you have to explain everything in our universe, but then you then have to give this metaphysical account of alternate universes and some sort of multiverse theory. So it's a very bloated kind of metaphysical theory. So there better be darn good reason for believing in it, and it better have strong explanatory adequacy to explain things we do understand and do have access to. Otherwise, there's just no reason to believe in them. And I think that's a very good point right off the bat.
Sure. And there are a lot of people, Zachary, I think, and I have been this person, I think, at times in my life where I'm saying, what difference does it make? This is the universe that I live in. So therefore, this is the only universe that matters. And I think there may be people listening to the podcast who may be feeling the same way. Well, what difference does it make? Well, it's fun to talk about and to theorize. And certainly Star Trek found it interesting enough to kind of hang a number. I mean, if you look up the number of episodes that deal with this in either in the majority of the episode or whether they touch on it within the episode, the amount of Star Trek that's dedicated to this is staggering. So as Star Trek fans, it should matter. We should be having these discussions. There is a difference here that can be made. And the difference is just a greater understanding of the universe that we live in and how it may or may not be affected by the choices that we make.
I love the way you ask questions, Mike, because you really have a way of asking questions that gets to the heart of the matter. And you asked a really important question, which is, why should we care about alternate universes if we're just trying to live our lives here in the ordinary universe, the actual universe? And I think the answer to that is that we do all the time rely on concepts and types of reasoning that don't obviously correspond to things here in the actual universe. We sometimes say things like something is possible or something is necessary or something would have been the case if something had happened counterfactually, you know, contrary to what happens here in the real world. And there has to be something to account for the truth of those kinds of statements. If we think that truth is a matter of correspondence to reality in some way, like there's this ordinary sense of truth, right? Like if I say, you know, Sulu is at the helm, that's true if Sulu is at the helm, right? I mean, that's an obvious like correspondence theory of truth, right? The bit of language is true if it points to something that is actually the case in the actual world inside the Star Trek universe or not. But there are lots of things that aren't obviously true in that sense. Like if I say something like, if Spock had completed his colon R in Star Trek the Motion Picture, then he wouldn't have any more emotions. That's not something that actually happened, right? He didn't actually complete his colon R.
Right.
But if he had, then maybe he wouldn't have any more emotions. That might be a true statement, again, in the Star Trek universe, but it doesn't obviously correspond to anything that actually happened in the Star Trek universe. So if we think that truth has to correspond to something, then it's an interesting question. What does it actually correspond to? So one use of possible universes is to explain the semantics of truth and falsity for these counterfactual statements. There was a philosopher named David Lewis who is really the champion of modal realism in the history of philosophy. And I was fortunate enough to meet David Lewis once, actually, at a conference when I was grad student at Syracuse about a month before he died. Yeah. It's not quite like meeting Socrates or Plato, but it is a matter of having met someone who people will remember in a couple hundred years. And so that is, you know, one of the high points of my career in philosophy is actually meeting David Lewis. But he basically used possible universes to explain the truth and falsity of counterfactual statements, basically saying that if you look at the sphere of all the possible universes, all the logically consistent universes out there, some are going to be more similar to ours and some are going to be wildly different than ours. Mm-hmm. If you look at the possible universes that are most closely related to ours. So if we're talking about the Star Trek universe, all other things being equal, no major changes, not like Spock was killed in a shuttlecraft accident, none of these crazy possible universes, no possible universe where life got wiped out on Earth billions of years ago. The ordinary possible universes that are mostly like the actual universe with one or two little changes. So all the other extraneous details being equal, a relevantly similar possible universe where Spock actually completed his colon R, then you could say, well, then he wouldn't have any more emotions. So a statement like, if Spock had completed his colon R in Star Trek The Motion Picture, then he wouldn't have any more emotions, is true, not because it points to something in the actual universe, but it refers to a relevantly similar possible universe that is similar enough to ours to be relevant, but different in that key respect.
But while Prime Spock is bemoaning the fact that he didn't complete colon R, he suddenly remembers that the extra time spent in the desert, although he had no emotions, he was attacked by a Saylot and died.
See, so that would not be a relevantly similar possible universe.
It's not so bad. Prime Spock, it's not so bad.
That would not be a relevantly similar possible universe.
Indeed.
Spock has to live to be relevantly similar. So that's one way of trying to show that alternate universes can be relevant to, you know, the actual universe and the way we reason and talk, because we do think about life counterfactually all the time. We do say things like, if I had decided to study computer engineering versus philosophy, I'd be making a lot more money than I make now. We say things like that all the time. And this counterfactual reasoning needs some sort of semantics, right? We need some account of what makes statements like that true, because we can't appeal to truth in the ordinary sense, because those things that we're positing, the counterfactual suppositions that we're reasoning from, aren't in the actual universe. That's what makes them counterfactual. So short of making those kinds of statements meaningless and neither true nor false, if we really want to think that there are true statements that are counterfactual, there is some philosophical and linguistic burden to explain what makes those statements true.
Yeah, and as an author, I can say that there is a difference between making a counterfactual statement and just making a fictional statement, and I think you have to make the distinction.
So in addition to things like counterfactuals, we have other concepts, and these concepts are called modal concepts, which is where the term modal realism comes from. Things like possibility and necessity. Mm-hmm. We do think certain things are possible, even if they're not actual. So one way of making sense of those kinds of statements is to appeal to possible worlds. So a Star Trek-inspired statement like, it's possible that Ricky Redshirt died on an away mission, isn't true in the actual universe, right? It's if he didn't actually go on the away mission, didn't actually die, if it's possible that he died. One way of making sense of a statement about possibility is to give a semantic reading of it kind of like this. In some possible universe, in at least one possible universe, Ensign Ricky Redshirt died on an away mission. Not in the actual universe, but in some possible universe out there. So it's possible that he died on an away mission. Likewise, if something is necessary, like it's necessary that Q is omniscient. That's an interesting statement. That might actually be true by definition in the Star Trek universe.
Right.
What that means, given these possible world semantics, is that in all possible universes, Q is omniscient. There's no possible universe in which Q is not omniscient. So that's a way of making sense of this stronger sense of truth that we call necessity, not just true in the actual world, but true in all possible worlds, true no matter what.
And I think that we can dial into that and call that absolute truth, because it is true no matter what universe you're in.
Yeah, things that are true by definition, or metaphysically true in some way.
Yes. Yes.
So not just that they happen to be true, because there are lots of things that happen to be true, like, you know, Ensign Riki Redshirt dies on an away mission, or Spock completing his colon R. Those may or may not be true, but there's nothing that necessarily makes them true. But there are some things that are necessarily true, and that stronger sense of necessity, Q being omniscient, or in Christian theology, God being omniscient and omnipotent, or omnipresent, or the truth of mathematics. Those kinds of things have this stronger sense of truth that we call necessity. And so possible world semantics is an interesting way of giving a reading of the truth and falsity of these different levels of truth, from possibility to truth in the actual world to true in all possible worlds. But the burden there is to explain why we should think they really exist. Are those purely linguistic constructions in the way that extra dimensions are mathematical constructions for string theory, or are they real? And the interesting thing about David Lewis is he thought that possible worlds or possible universes weren't just linguistic constructions for explanatory adequacy. He thought they were metaphysically real, just that we happen to live in one of them that we happen to call the actual universe.
Right. And I have to say, as someone who has an interest in ancestry and genealogy, and still a Star Trek fan, I want to just kind of pause here for a second and point to the Mirror Universe. Now, I enjoy the exploration of the Mirror Universe as much as any Star Trek fan. I think that they're occasionally hilarious, and for instance, in Discovery, Tilly's character is Captain Killy in the Mirror Universe. I think that's hilarious. However, where there is a part of me that kind of takes a step back and does a face palm, maybe rolls my eyes a little bit, is that we assume in this Mirror Universe a lot. We are a collection of genetic material that goes back to the dawn of time. In order for me to be me, not only would my parents had to have met and created me, but their parents and their parents before them, and so on and so forth, going back to the dawn of time. Otherwise, I'm not me. I'm somebody else completely. I mean, you go back into my genetic tree, two or three generations, and pull out, for instance, let's just say my fifth great grandfather, and you insert somebody else. I'm no longer me. I'm somebody else. So the Mirror Universe assumes that we all exist there genetically unaltered. And I think that's a little ridiculous.
Well, the contrast between the Mirror Universe and what you see in something like Parallels, or even something like Tapestry, where mm-hmm. the Enterprise D is largely the same, except for the fact that Captain Picard is now Lieutenant Picard. There's a huge contrast there, because the Mirror Universe doesn't just have one or two of these little changes. There are a great number of differences that are all, it's like a string of contingent things that all are different, yet somehow they add up to the same people being there. I mean, if the Mirror Universe is so different from ours in almost every respect, it's supposed to be an opposite universe, and it has a different historical trend and different politics, and somehow all the same people are there, and their parents happen to meet, and their grandparents happen to meet, and their great-great-great-grandparents happen to meet, this kind of ancestral take on it that you just gave a moment ago. It doesn't really add up. Like, if all those contingent events were different, how do we still have the same people when you know, individual people are such a consequence of their specific DNA and their parents and grandparents? Yes. And their ancestral chain. So I get where you're going there. And I think David Lewis would just say that it is a possible universe, right? There's nothing internally inconsistent about it. It's just not a relevantly similar possible universe, right? It's so different from ours that it's not similar to ours in the way that the different universes that you see in Parallels are similar, or the different universes that you see, or the alternate universe that you see in Tapestry, for example, would be similar to ours in almost every other respect, except for one or two key differences. So it wouldn't have the kind of explanatory adequacy that I think David Lewis is looking for to explain things like counterfactuals. It's just too different from ours, right? How would you keep track of all the different counterfactual changes in the mirror universe compared to universes that are largely like ours or largely like the actual universe in the Star Trek universe, but with one or two key differences where you can really drill down and say, okay, this is a really relevantly similar universe. There are one or two things that are counterfactually different. So we can make these simple counterfactual statements that we want mm-hmm. to be able to make.
Yeah. And the interesting thing here and the distinction I think that we need to be made, I think I can explain anecdotally. When I was a senior in high school, there were a lot of people who thought that I would probably follow my older sister and go to the Art Institute in Pittsburgh and pursue a career in commercial art in some form or another. However, at that particular time in my life, my interest was actually going into the Air Force. I wanted to be part of the flight program in some way, and for that matter, I was on a trajectory to do that until I flunked an eye exam. And at that time, they wouldn't allow pilots in who had corrected vision. That's changed since then. But, you know, that was my interest. And when I flunked that eye exam, I had to change my trajectory in life. So I ended up going to college and onto seminary and so on and so forth. And so, you know, completely different path than what people expected or even the trajectory that I was on in my life. But in some universe somewhere, there is a version of me that went into commercial art, and there's some version of me perhaps that didn't flunk an eye exam and is maybe flying combat missions right now. I don't know. Maybe retired. Maybe I'm a colonel or so. I don't know. But and then there's, you know, me here now. I'm a pastor and an author and a podcaster.
So since we're talking about counterfactuals,
yeah, definitely
complete
about
the following counterfactual statement for me, Mike. If Mike had gone into the Air Force and become a pilot, his call sign would be.
I can't answer that.
You're saying that all of the possible universes in which you're a fighter pilot are not relevantly similar to ours?
Baldy now, I think, would be my call sign. Not back in those days.
Baldy.
I had plenty of hair but in my younger days, but now I think it would be Baldy. But I think that's what we see in parallels in the shuttlecraft scene. We see all of these different versions of Worf. We see Worf in a gold uniform. We see Worf in a command uniform. We know that Worf won the tournament. We know that there's a version of Worf on there that didn't win the tournament because somebody cheated. And there's certainly a version of Worf that didn't even get to participate in the tournament. So I think those are all counterfactuals.
Yeah, and I think those types of possible universes are the ones that David Lewis would say have the greatest amount of explanatory adequacy. Those are the mm-hmm. ones we can say they're relevantly similar to the actual universe. There's one or two key changes. So we can say things like, if Worf had won the Batleth tournament, then he would have filled in the blank, right? We can right. make these kinds of counterfactual statements. The mirror universe is different, though. It's so different that it's hard to figure out what it would explain. What kinds of sentences can we say about the mirror universe or sentences here in the actual universe that the mirror universe helps us explain? It's just too different of a universe. The interesting thing about David Lewis and modal realism is he thinks that it's not just the relevantly similar universes that exist, but all of the possible universes exist. The ones that are wildly different from the actual universe, the ones that have completely different laws of physics, the ones where life didn't even get started on Earth. You know, pick your favorite, you know, logically consistent thing. They're all real and they all exist. It's just that some of them aren't very useful for explaining the kinds of statements he thinks need explaining, like counterfactuals and these modal statements about possibility and necessity. So when I watch Parallels and I think about it in terms of what else we see in Star Trek, like with the Mirror Universe, the question that comes up for me inside the Star Trek universe is whether the Mirror Universe is just one of those many parallel universes that we see in Parallels. There seems to be something special about the Mirror Universe, right? It's some sort of direct opposition to the actual universe, whereas all the other universes that we see in Parallels are more like branches off the actual universe, and you know, like quantum branching theory, where different, you know, with every event there's a quantum branch, and the universe splits and splits and splits in a tree-like fashion. But all of the branches are very similar to the universe that they branched from. But the Mirror Universe doesn't seem to work like that. The Mirror Universe seems to be some sort of special, you know, extra special direct opposition to the actual universe in Star Trek.
Yeah, it's kind of a bizarro Star Trek where everything is kind of opposite of what it is here. I could understand, using my example of Tilly earlier, I can understand if Tilly, for instance, decided to pursue a life of crime, say, instead of going to the academy and becoming a Starfleet officer. I can see where you could have two completely different Tillys, but to have an entire universe that's kind of gone amok, that seems to me it's very difficult for me to wrap my head around that. I can wrap my head around this quantum branching theory that we get in Parallels, and we certainly get that, I think, to a degree in Tapestry as well. It's this counterfactual of Jean-Luc Picard saying, you know, if I hadn't have been such a cocky, impulsive young officer and got myself stabbed through the heart, and, you know, I'd be a different person, and maybe I'd be a better captain. And what Q kind of shows him is that, you know, even in this impulsive choice, this impulsive decision that he made to fight the Nausicaan, it really is part of the best version of himself that he's become. And so, you know, I think both of those are really good examples of this kind of quantum branching theory. Certainly, I don't think either of those examples can even loosely be tied to what we get in a Mirror Universe.
So it sounds like you're going to be lobbying CBS for a spinoff show about Tilly in an alternate universe and her life of crime, like Tilly and Clyde or something like that.
Yeah, Captain Killy, and she's a pirate, Zach. She's
Tilly the pirate.
She is a pirate. Yes. Yeah. I think I would definitely want to be a writer on that series. Again, I just defer back to the principle of parsimony. I'm going for simpler solutions in the hope and belief that they're more likely to be correct rather than something much more complex.
Well, in response to that, Mike, in the uses of possible universes that we've seen in philosophy, you know, to explain the truth of counterfactuals, to explain the truth of modal statements about possibility and necessity, that's an interesting example of how this sort of metaphysically heavy supposition that alternate universes exist can have explanatory adequacy here in the actual universe, that there are things that we think are true here in the actual universe that we can't explain unless we posit the existence of other possible universes. So is that a violation of Occam's razor? Is that a violation of the principle of parsimony? Is it too metaphysically heavy? I think you could look at the mathematics of string theory and say, you know, it's great that you got the math to work, you know, cosmologist or string theorist, but that doesn't mean 23 dimensions really exist, right? You know, just because you made the equations work out right. I think you could say the same thing here. You can go, yeah, we need some way of explaining the law-like relationship between cause and effect in these counterfactual statements. Like, you know, if Spock completed his colon R, then he wouldn't have any emotions, right? There's a cause and effect relationship there. If Captain Kirk had beamed down, then Ensign Ricky Redshirt wouldn't have died on the away mission. Okay, there's a cause and effect relationship there. But why do we need to appeal to this metaphysically heavy construct of this multiverse of possible universes purely to explain what is ostensibly just a simple little cause and effect relationship that doesn't happen to be true in the actual universe, but very well could have been, and seems like it would be true whether or not possible universes exist?
For sure.
So I guess you can be, I think it's So I think it's prudent to take a position of skepticism in response to modal realism. It's such a metaphysically heavy proposition that you don't want to, you know, swallow the pill of it too easily. It's important to stand back and go, wait a minute, can we really explain all these things we want to explain without appealing to those things?
Yes, and regardless, again, this is the universe that I exist in. Therefore, it's the only one that really matters.
I don't know. I think the one where you become a fighter pilot is a universe that matters.
Colonel Baldy.
So, Mike, before we move on, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the history of possible universes in philosophy way predates the history of possible universes in science fiction. It goes all the way back to the German philosopher Gottfried Leibniz, who is famous for this phrase, the best of all possible worlds. And I think we actually get that phrase in Star Trek from time to time. And of course, he wasn't thinking about science fiction. He was thinking about Christian theology. But for him, he was trying to explain the problem of evil. Well, if God can do anything, why is the universe so bad? Yeah. Why do all these evil things happen? Why are people bad? Why do natural disasters happen? You know, well-trodden territory about the problem of evil. But his argument kind of went something like this. He would say, well, God has the idea of infinitely many universes. He can conceive of anything, right? Any way the universe could have been. But only one of these universes can actually exist, you know, the actual world, the actual universe. God is good, you know, basic principle of Christian theology.
Right.
Therefore, the universe that God chose to exist is the best of all possible worlds. He could have created any number of other possible worlds, but he created the best one, and we happen to live in the best one. It's kind of it's really a weak argument, right? I mean, we obviously don't live in the best of all possible universes. Like, it'd be a better world if people didn't suffer and people weren't killed, sure, and natural disasters didn't happen and the Notre Dame Cathedral didn't burn down and all these things that happen in the actual world. Surely the world would be better if those things didn't happen. So it's not really that great of an argument, obviously, but it does introduce this concept of possible worlds. And I think it's just fascinating that that concept predates science fiction by centuries.
And it's a very science fiction kind of mental exercise that he's embarked on here. And really, in a lot of ways, Leibniz was ahead of his time.
Well, I think it has the obvious flaw of pointing out all of the bad things in the universe and calling them good.
Yeah, for sure.
I think there's something just inherently kind of specious about that from a theological standpoint or from a moral standpoint, any standpoint. It's just not a very good argument. But what I do
well,
like about the
it,
argument
if everything
is that
in the world was good, we'd have no reason to create a series like Star Trek that gives us this optimistic view of the future. We'd have no reason to dream about a better possible future.
Yeah. What's interesting about Leibniz is that he wasn't saying that we live in a perfect world. He was saying we live in the best of all the imperfect worlds, if that makes any sense.
I think that's a fair way of putting it.
What I like about his argument, though, is that he is trying to do basically what David Lewis was trying to do, explain some feature of the actual world. For David Lewis, it was counterfactual statements and causality. For Leibniz, it was the moral character of the universe, the fact that we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world where people do bad things. And he was trying to use possible worlds to explain something in the actual world. It's a very interesting move because, you know, you started out with the skeptical position, like, why should I care about possible worlds or alternate universes when I'm trying to live in the actual world? But David Lewis and Leibniz were both trying to explain something in the actual world that can only be explained by invoking possible worlds.
Well, you use the example of the statement, you know, Q is omnipotent, and that statement being true across the universes in Star Trek. Well, Leibniz does something similar by anchoring all of his thought on this subject on this one core truth, and that is God is good. And he makes the assumption that across the universes, that's universally true. God is good. And from there, he kind of branches out and develops his thoughts on the topic.
That's a really interesting parallel, the parallel between Q is omnipotent and that's necessarily true in all possible worlds is similar to Leibniz saying God is good in all possible universes across possible worlds.
Yes.
Except Q's not always good. He means well. sometimes.
He does mean well, but I think you're right. He's not always good. Sometimes he's just a menace.
So one question I wanted to talk about, Mike, is whether this question of possible universes or alternate universes, and it goes by different names. Scientists tend to call it multiverse theory, and people in science fiction tend to call it alternate universes, mm-hmm. and philosophy tends to call it possible worlds. I think there's a lot of overlap there. There's some semantic differences between those, but let's just lump them all together and call them the same thing for the sake of simplicity. The interesting question to me is whether that is a scientific question or whether it is a philosophical question. Because scientists tend to weigh in on this too. Cosmologists and theoretical physicists tend to dabble in multiverse theory, right? Well, maybe the Big Bang is just one of many Big Bangs. Maybe the universe, you know, expands and collapses. Maybe the Big Bang happened when different multiverses collide into each other. There's a whole host of different ways of thinking about how the Big Bang theory happened and what that might mean in some larger multiverse beyond the actual universe. And it's very speculative. Some scientists are very critical of that as a scientific question, basically saying that it's not empirically verifiable, it's not falsifiable, it's not testable. You know, these things that anchor genuine scientific theories as something genuinely scientific, writing them off as more metaphysical or purely philosophical, something outside the domain of science. And yet so many scientists want to weigh in on it. I find it very interesting that given all the skepticism about multiverse theory being testable or being falsifiable, that so many scientists seem to have an opinion on it, or at least find it interesting. It's all very speculative, of course. Does that automatically kind of ipso facto put it in the domain of philosophy and metaphysics, or does science have something to say about it? I don't know if I have the answer to that question. As I was preparing for the podcast, I did take the time to look up some different views on what multiverse theory might actually mean from a scientific or cosmological standpoint. And I found some different sort of categories of multiverse theory from a couple of different theoretical physicists that we can talk about. But I just find it an interesting question. Like, if it's clearly about something material, right? If other universes are real in this modal realism sense, in the sense of alternate universes being real in the Star Trek universe, they're real in the same way our universe is real, right? So there's nothing like spooky metaphysical about them. There just happen to be a different physical universe that's exactly like our physical universe, except mm-hmm. with some differences. So they're not like spooky. I guess that's the best way to put it. Spooky metaphysical. It's not like, you know, we're not talking ghosts and we're not talking abstract properties and we're not talking, you know, spooky Cartesian dualism, non-physical entities and all these other things that metaphysicians like to talk about. So we're just talking about ordinary physical universes that are different from our ordinary physical universe.
Right.
So that makes it sound like it's in the domain of science. But kind of by definition, alternate universes are outside of our physical universe. We can't see them. We can't taste them. We can't investigate them. We can't falsify anything about them. We can't say anything is true about them, except in this counterfactual sense that David Lewis was talking about and linguists talk about. So what does that mean? Does that mean it's automatically a philosophical, metaphysical question and not a scientific one anymore, even though we're still talking about physical universes that just happen to be different from our physical universe? I don't have the answer to that, but I find the question of which domain it really belongs in really interesting.
Yeah, and they're not spatially or temporally connected. So it's not like we can somehow pick ourselves up and go there.
Well, in Star Trek, you can, right? And, you know, the barriers between quantum universes break down all the time in Star Trek. And you can jump from one universe to the other in Star Trek. Sure. Why isn't there like an exodus of universes, right? Why don't people try to find the best possible universe in Star Trek? And well, you know, why aren't people jumping ship on the actual universe, trying to find a better possible universe? You know, like where they're captain of a starship or something. Just like you want to be a fighter pilot.
Just pull the bones and jump through a gateway.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's not a wagon train to the stars. It's a wagon train to an alternate universe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we have all kinds of ways in Star Trek to get to these places, right? I mean, we have gateways and we have slingshot maneuvers and
transporter.
And we have transporter accidents. Yeah. And
sure,
there are all kinds of, yeah, yeah. The Q continuum. I mean, Q can take us there.
Yeah, he did with Captain Picard and Tapestry. Sure.
Yeah, and one science fiction writer called it the space between the spaces. And I think that's interesting when you're talking about some of these possibilities of other domains, like subspace domains that we get in the Star Trek universe. We have these subspace domains. For instance, schisms. When Riker was being abducted by these subspace beings, and he's taken to this subspace manifold domain, he's literally being taken out of his space to space between spaces.
So that's an interesting question. So in a case like that, where Riker is taken to some other level in subspace, whatever that means, was he taken to an alternate universe in the David Lewis sense, like what's happening in Parallels? Or is he being taken to another dimension, another realm in the actual universe? I don't think that's obvious at all. I tended to read it more like the latter, that it was still in the actual universe, just in some sort of subspace realm of the actual universe.
Exactly. And Deep Space Nine dealt with this, I think, pretty effectively in the episode Playing God, where they talked about new universes that were being formed in subspace naturally inside something that they referred to as subspace interface pockets. Again, the space between the spaces. They've not left our universe. They're just going to these interface pockets, the space between the spaces.
Well, this might be a good segue into talking about the different classifications that I found from actual scientists and cosmologists about different types of possible universes, because really what we're talking about are different ways of reading this term, alternate universe or possible universe, and there's different senses of this. So I wasn't familiar with this before we started recording today. I looked it up earlier today, but there's this cosmologist named Max Tegmark, who I hadn't heard of, so I'm not, you know, touting my cosmological credentials here, but one way of reading an alternate universe or possible universe is as an extension of our universe, you know, other realms of our universe that are not accessible to us. And are you familiar with the concept of an observable universe, Mike?
Vaguely, yes.
Basically, there are at any location in the universe, there is a sphere around us where we can see things and have access to things because we have the possibility of light from those distances reaching us. Outside that sphere, further away, things are so far away that the light from those places will literally never reach us. So mm-hmm. We'll literally never have access to them, even though they're part of the same universe. So they're kind of a different epistemic bubble, if you will, inside the very same universe. It's not spooky. It's not metaphysical. It's not even a different possible universe. It's not an alternate universe at all. It's part of our actual universe that we'll literally never have access to because it's too far away. Light will never reach us from there. Because we're expanding away from it at a certain rate. It's kind of an Edwin Hubble way of thinking about the universe.
Yes.
So that's level one, an extension of our universe, but places we'll never have access to. Level two are universes with different physical constants. So other universes like ours, but with different physical laws, different physical constants, different laws of nature, whatever. Level three are what's called the mini worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. So this is the branching thing that we're seeing in Parallels, right? The universe branches with every event. There's another way the event could have gone, and the universe branches and branches and branches. It's interesting whether that is part of the actual universe or whether those are literally alternate universes in some strong sense. I don't think it's, you know, his description is totally clear about that. And level four is what's called the ultimate ensemble. So this radically multiverse theory. So, you know, take all the different logically consistent possible worlds. This is a very David Lewis concept. All the different logically consistent possible worlds or different mathematical models of the universe or possible universes. And the multiverse would be all of those kind of in toto taken as a whole. So if we're talking about Riker being drawn into subspace, which is it? Is he being taken into an extension of our universe, you know, another realm, another dimension in our universe? Or is he crossing a quantum barrier? It doesn't seem like what's happening in Parallels is what's happening in Schisms. Or is he being taken into some logically different possible universe in the sort of David Lewis sense? Kind of like what you see in Parallels or you know, is it like more like the mirror universe? Is it more like the universe in Tapestry where Picard's not the captain anymore, that kind of thing? I read it a little more as level one, that it's still part of the actual universe. It's just a different dimension, a different realm, a different whatever. You know, this is all, you know, science fiction, right? So in the Star Trek universe, subspace is part of the actual universe. There's nothing, you know, trans-universal about subspace in Star Trek, right? It's still in the actual universe. It's just another realm in the actual universe.
Yeah, and I think another good example of what we see in schisms we get in Deep Space Nine with the Prophets. They live outside of time, and for that matter, to some degree, space, but they're still very much a part of our universe. And if they choose to, they can interact and intervene, and we see them do that in Deep Space Nine, interact and intervene with our universe. So I think, as it is true in Schisms, it's also true with the Prophets in Deep Space Nine. That's more of a level one. They're part of our universe. I agree.
Well, let me ask you this. So one of the criticisms of multiverse theory from a scientific standpoint is that it's not a testable hypothesis. You can't empirically verify it. You can't falsify any suppositions about it. You can't test anything about it. It's purely metaphysical. But in the Star Trek universe, it seems to posit that there are ways of transiting from universe to universe, you know, in one of these forms, right? You either get drawn into subspace, mm-hmm. you jump on a transporter, and you end up in the mirror universe. The barriers between quantum realities break down, and from episode to episode, you're thrown in a different universe. It happens all the time, right?
Yeah.
Does that put it squarely back in the domain of science? You know, even if we can't test it now, does what we're seeing in the Star Trek universe show that that suppositions about alternate universes are in principle testable, in principle falsifiable, in principle verifiable? Maybe not for us here in the actual universe today, right now, but maybe someday when we do learn how to transit from universe to universe. Does that kind of, you know, non-spookiness of what we're seeing in Star Trek show that these really are scientific suppositions, just ones we can't verify today?
Though we cannot right now, with our current level of understanding and technology, verify and quantify the existence of parallel universes or quantum universes, whatever you want to call them. Though we can't do that now, I think it may be possible in the future. I think Star Trek has proven that if you take a scientific concept and you come up with a reasonable hypothesis, in time, science will catch up, and what was once science fiction can someday possibly become science fact. So I don't dare dismiss the possibility that sometime in the future, we may come up with a way to break down the barriers and explore the space between the spaces.
See, to me, this is one of the obvious advantages that philosophy has over the sciences, right? Here we're running into a hard and fast limit about what science can tell us, right? We don't have empirical access to these alternate universes. We can't verify anything. We can't falsify anything. We can't test anything. But you can look at what David Lewis and other philosophers of language and other metaphysicians are trying to do with the concept of possible universes. They would say, we know lots of things about possible universes. We can reason about them like crazy. We do have counterfactual statements that we think are true. We do think certain things are possible or necessary, these modal concepts that we talk about. Mm-hmm. We have intuitions about them. We can falsify counterfactual propositions logically using reason. We can appeal to laws of nature and reason about how alternate universes would be different or similar to ours based on laws of nature that we do understand. So there are lots of things we know about possible universes, even though science can't touch them. So here it seems like philosophy has an advantage over science from the perspective of possible universes. I think sometimes we make the mistake of thinking that science has to be this kind of naive scientism, that the only things that are meaningful are the things that science can tell us, or the only things that we know are the things we know from science. If insofar as our ordinary day-to-day reasoning and use of language does rely on things like counterfactuals, it seems like there are lots of things we know that aren't purely scientific, and, you know, whether they're possible universes or otherwise. So you might use possible universes and their explanatory function for things like counterfactuals and modal concepts as just an argument against this naive scientism that some people seem to have.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. And I tend to agree with that. I think sometimes
we can be a bit naive, and I think that we run the risk of overlooking possibilities when, you know, Spock famously said there are always possibilities. And I think that's true in our world, just the same as it's true in the Star Trek universe. I think that there are always possibilities. And I simply have to go back to the history of science and point out that, you know, there was a time, for instance, when Galileo was thought to be a heretic, and I mean, burn this guy at the stake. This is heresy. But it took a theory, and then the science to develop in which we were able to prove that theory in order for us to get to where we are today. Now we look back and we say, Galileo was a genius. He was ahead of his time. But again, I think that we can be very naive. And while there are oftentimes, I think in the world of modern science, crazy ideas that come out that are just out there, I don't know any other way to put it. I think it's naive for us to just kind of wave a hand and say, well, you know, that's just a crazy idea. I think if we can theorize about the possibilities of other subspace domains or quantum realities, I think we owe it to ourselves to work towards trying to prove or disprove those theories.
Yeah, well, it sounds kind of obvious to me that, you know, today's science fiction is tomorrow's science fact. Like, the things that don't sound like they're scientific today, they don't sound testable, they don't sound verifiable, they don't sound falsifiable, might be someday. It's not that they're not scientific in principle, they're just not scientific in practice, given the limitations of science right now. I think if you look at the history of science, there are lots of things that were mere suppositions that could have been written off as metaphysical or purely speculative, that as science got better and better and better, or advanced or changed, even in some sort of paradigm shift way, even if science isn't linear, there were things that were purely speculative that couldn't be tested at the time that eventually became testable. It does seem sort of just premature to write off something as in principle non-scientific when we don't know what the limits of science are and what will be testable in the future, especially when we're talking about alternate universes, which are in theory just physical universes like ours. So there should be lots of things that are testable about them if we could access them. So they're not untestable in principle, they're just untestable in practice.
Yeah, in the mid-1960s, when Gene Roddenberry and the writers of Star Trek were telling these interesting stories about AI run amok, AI was little more than a theory. And now I can't hardly imagine the world that we live in today without the developments that are being made in AI and how much it intersects our day-to-day lives.
Well, Mike, as you and I have been talking, we've been giving a philosopher like David Lewis a lot of credit. He's using possible universes to explain counterfactuals, and other philosophers have used them to talk about the truth or falsity of modal language, like, you know, something being possible or something being necessary. We should at least talk about one of the criticisms of that view, and I think this is a little strange. If the whole point of invoking possible universes to explain those kinds of statements, counterfactual statements, in the Star Trek universe or not in the Star Trek universe, I think there's a really interesting consequence of that. Like, let's use the statement you were talking about earlier. If you had become a fighter pilot, your call sign would be Baldy.
Hmm.
Right? Let's use that as an example.
Yeah, thanks for coming back to that.
No problem. Part of the reason for invoking possible universes is the view that true statements need to correspond to something. They need to point to something, right? In the ordinary sense, you know, true statements point to something that's true in the actual world. In this kind of counterfactual sense, true counterfactuals point to another possible universe. That's David Lewis's insight about possible universes. I think it's really strange to say that if we're making a counterfactual statement about you, if you had been a fighter pilot, your call sign would be Baldy, that that statement isn't referring to you anymore in the actual universe. It's referring to alternate you in another possible universe. And that's who I'm talking about when I make a counterfactual statement. I think it's weird to say that every time I make a counterfactual statement, I'm talking about another possible universe. I don't think that's what I mean to say when I say a counterfactual statement. Like, let's come up with one from the Star Trek universe. Like, maybe something from Star Trek 2009. If Vulcan had been destroyed, then Captain Kirk's father saves 800 lives as captain of the whatever ship that was. I can't remember. I'm terrible at this.
Kelvin.
Kelvin, thank you.
USS Kelvin.
Right, so there's a counterfactual statement in the Star Trek universe. If Vulcan were destroyed, Captain Kirk's father would save 800 lives on the Kelvin. Okay. That might actually work, right? If you say, who are we talking about if we're making this counterfactual statement about Kirk? Are we talking about Kirk in the actual universe, the prime universe? Or are we now all of a sudden referring to Kirk in the alternate universe or Kirk's father in the alternate universe? Maybe that works a little better in the Star Trek universe where it's just taken for granted that alternate universes exist in some way. You know, for us, alternate universes seem bloated and heavy and metaphysical and kind of like a big ad hoc hypothesis to explain something ordinary. But in the Star Trek universe, if you say that alternate universes exist, maybe every time you do give a counterfactual statement in the Star Trek universe, you really are talking about alternate whomever.
Well, I'm glad you brought the Kelvin universe into this, Zachary, because I think it's relevant and it gets a lot of hate, but you know, it really, I think, did a lot to kind of explore this subject. In the Kelvin universe, things do change. George Kirk is not the same George Kirk that we have in the prime universe, although we know very little about George Kirk in the prime universe. One thing that we do know is that he inspired Jim Kirk, James Kirk, to go into Starfleet. He still did that in the Kelvin universe, but in a very different way. He became an anecdote that Christopher Pike used to recruit Jim Kirk. And I think it's interesting when Kelvin universe Kirk encounters prime universe Spock, he kind of reconciles these two things, but they're still not the same people. Spock says, I am and forever shall always be your friend. But he really wasn't the friend of Kelvin universe Kirk, because Spock and Kelvin Spock and Kelvin Kirk are anything but friends. So I think that's interesting that Spock makes this distinction that even in the Kelvin universe, he's still Jim Kirk's friend.
So it should have been something more like, I would have been your friend and always will might have been someday subjunctively.
That's exactly been your friend, what,
right? Okay.
That's exactly my point.
If you were really who you say you are, then I would have always been your friend. Yeah.
I might have been your friend.
In a relevantly possible universe, I would have been your friend, Jim. Oh, philosophy jokes.
So, I mean, seriously, thank you for mentioning the Kelvin universe, because I think that's relevant to our conversation. Spock, Prime Spock and Kelvin Kirk weren't friends, but yet Spock doesn't make the decision, the distinction there.
Well, I think there this is an interesting insight about possible universes, and I think an insight that David Lewis would probably think is clever. That possible universes diverge from each other, right? Two possible universes that start out as identical, where one tiny difference branches them in some way, whether in some quantum sense or whether they were always just different possible universes to begin with, you know, whichever way you want to read it. From that point on, the universes are different and they will have different trajectories. They continue to branch and diverge. And I think that's what we're seeing in the Kelvin universe, right? There was one key difference, you know, one event, you know, happened when Nero went back in time, changed mm-hmm. history. From that point on, the universes got more and more and more and more different, the prime universe and the Kelvin universe.
Right. Yeah, I think in an alternate universe, you know, you and I met seemingly by chance doing a patron's roundtable early on in the history of Patrons Roundtable. We were on a roundtable together.
Number two.
We met. We clicked. We had a conversation, and 93 episodes later, here we are. Perhaps in an alternate universe, I decided not to do the second Patrons Roundtable, and you're doing Metatrex with somebody else, or maybe you're not doing Metatrex. I don't know. Maybe there's a universe where you are and a universe where you aren't. But in any universe, Zachary, you are and forever shall be my beloved co-host and friend.
You're saying it's necessary in all possible universes. We are friends. That's a nice thought.
It's necessary.
I don't know. I don't think it's true. I think there are some possible universes that are relevantly dissimilar to ours where that's not true. But
where you and I never met because one of us decided not to participate in that roundtable discussion. And because you are in one part of the country and I am in another, we never knew each other.
You're a fighter pilot and I've won the Battle tournament. In that universe, maybe we're not friends. So I will settle for saying that in all of the relevantly similar possible universes, you and I are friends.
Well, frankly, this is the only one that matters. So this is the best possible.
Yes. You're saying we're in the best possible podcast in the best possible universe?
This is the best possible podcast.
That's a nice thought, Mike. I don't know if it's true, but it's a nice thought. Counterfactually true.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about alternate universes, possible universes today on Metatrex. But this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
But I don't know, like that one, as I was looking through the examples, I was like, that's pretty badass to just take that risk. And I think Riker's taken it back. He's like, you're going to kill Deanna? No, don't do that. But I think she convinces him, like, this is the way we have to do it. So I don't know. What do you think?
Wow, that was not even on my radar.
Well, of course, it's killing Troy.
Yeah.
You know?
Literary Treks.
It always frustrated me because on screen, we saw in depth the Klingon government, the Bajoran government, the Cardassian government, to a lesser extent, the Romulan government. We almost never saw the Federation government. You know, three times we saw a president. Once we saw the council. The council was mentioned any number of times, but we never really saw it.
Warp 5.
I thought it was cool when he hits it. And it's like knocking wood on a door.
So did they install like a wooden neck for him or something?
Right. It doesn't make any sense. You know what? I leave that up to, I guess, people had less knowledge of biology overall, you know, the general public in 1939. So, yeah. Whatever.
We're going to file that under, we just got to go with it, and we'll file that under our neck cannon.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Melodic Treks.
Star Trek 3 was Christopher Lloyd's crew, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, his impact on that culture and race of Klingons and the rest of the franchise is still being felt. And to me, he's my second favorite Star Trek movie villain, right? Khan would obviously be first, and then Krug is number two after that for me.
Not the whale probe?
Is the whale probe just misunderstood.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts about today's show, and there are many ways that you can mind meld with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. Well, Zachary, when you're not admiring your champion standing trophy from the Batlith tournament, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Baldy, when you're not going Mach 2 with your hair on fire? Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
That's what happened to my hair. It caught on fire. Absolutely. Thank you for mentioning that.
No problem.
Well, Zachary, you can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. On Instagram, I'm cmichael1701. You can also check out my website. It is cmichaelmorrison.com or hannahgoodhart.com. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more. All available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and a constant across all universes. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, our art director, Aaron Harvey, production manager, Richard Marquez, our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can catch him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble. Norm Lau, he is at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker at Mark74656. And Zachary, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.